Welcome to Keith and I Don't Tread on Anyone. Today we have Michael Munger. He is a professor of economics, public policy, and political science at Duke University. Today we're going to discuss his book, Is Capitalism Sustainable? From the American Institute for Economic Research. Mr. Munger, thank you for your time.
It is a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
How would you define capitalism?
Well, let me start by defining markets. Markets are a system of voluntary exchange. And the only exchanges that take place are those that make both or all parties to the exchange better off. Capitalism is a system that goes on top of markets, that is the allocation of one particular productive element of a market system, which is capital. Now, many people tend to think of capital as being physical stuff, but what capitalism is the ability to direct liquidity to high value opportunities. So the one word argument for capitalism is liquidity. Liquidity, liquidity, liquidity. Having the ability to say, here is a new way for us to serve each other. It is difficult to mobilize resources, but there are people who specialize in raising and allocating capital to high-valued uses. And value is determined by a set of signals that Austrian economists call profit and loss. Profits are a sign that we're not doing enough of that thing. Losses are a sign that we're doing too much of that thing. And it seems simple, but there is no alternative system that can either with the same rapidity or the same accuracy judge what people should be doing with their resources. So no bureaucrat, no elected official, they don't have the information and they don't have the correct incentives. They will get this wrong. The advantage of capitalism is that it directs resources that we towards things we should do more of to benefit citizens, and away from things that we should do less of to benefit systems. Now, the difficulty of capital for many people is that the distributional consequences are to create inequality. But it solves poverty. And so I'm always surprised when people on the left are worried about capitalism because they say they care about poor people. There is no other system. It's not that capitalism is better. There is no alternative system that will solve the problem of poverty. So a number of countries, Bernie Sanders often talks about the fact that, we should be more like Sweden, which is socialist. No, Sweden went to the edge. They looked over the edge into the abyss. And then they said, damn, that doesn't work. If we want to solve the problem of poverty, we have to be capitalist. So in the 1990s, Sweden sold off all its state-owned enterprises. They have a privatized system of pensions. They have a largely private system of education. Sweden is one of the most capitalist countries in the world. They have a very low corporate income tax. The argument for capitalism is that it solves the problem of poverty. Capitalism is best for poor people. Capitalist countries have fewer poor people than any other system, including socialist countries. Now, it is true that many of my colleagues on the left in the United States do have a problem. And Keith, it's called envy. They are envious. They went to school. They were good boys and girls. They got good grades. They should get more money. But there's these people that make stuff for a living called entrepreneurs, and they make way more money than I do. It's not fair. So they pretend to care about the poor when, in fact, all they care about is inequality.
Now, one might say capitalism is not sustainable because it is based on infinite growth and infinite consumption on a planet with finite resources. How do you respond?
I don't even understand the question. Isn't there an infinite amount of human creativity? And in fact, what has happened is that there were a bunch of people in the 1970s that were predicting global food crises, and London was going to have food riots. India was going to cease to exist because it couldn't feed itself. Our ability to come up with solutions to problems and to use resources, because when you say there's a finite amount of resources, I suppose that's true, but water, we can use water over and over again. All we have to do is clean it. What does it take to clean it? Money. So long as we have a system that generates money and capital, We have enough resources. And here's the other thing, the thing that surprises me. An awful lot of the things that have made our lives better are ways of doing more with less. So what resources does it use for me to write an app and then store it on some digital medium? So our ability to write software and to write computer programs that make our lives easier and better and cheaper is obviously infinite. So physical things we use over and over again. So I have sometimes said we should be burying plastic and metal in landfills, not recycling them, so that future generations can strip mine landfills and get those resources back. We're not using them up. We're just putting them in a slightly different form for a while. So we're not using up resources. And all the carbon that we're from fossil fuels, it's still there. We're not using it up. Now, you can say it's in the atmosphere, but with money and energy, it is still possible for us to get that back. So it is not true that the Earth has a finite amount of resources. What it is a relatively closed system with a really powerful source of energy called the sun coming in infinitely in terms of our present time horizons from outside. So we have an infinite source of energy, and we have more than sufficient amounts of natural resources because we can reuse them as long as we unshackle the most dynamic force that there is, which is human creativity. If we have the state to shackle human creativity, yes, I agree, we're screwed. Stop doing that.
How did you get into the mindset and assist people when they say that there's a number of problems right now and the way to solve them is to make things free? For example, for those of us who don't have food, make food free, make healthcare free, make college tuition free for everyone along with utilities and rent. How do you get into that mindset when you're discussing capitalism, economics, and scarcity?
Well, it always surprises me that many of the same people who say that are the same ones who recognize that the problem with global warming, suppose you think global warming is a really bad problem. The reason is that the atmosphere is available for free. I get to use it as a dumping ground from carbon from my tailpipe. Now, is it actually free? No. The price to me is free, but the cost to the world is substantial. Now, let's apply that same reasoning to college tuition. Is it free to get a college tuition? No, it's really expensive for a college education. A college education is really expensive. These people just want somebody else to pay for it. Does it cost money to make food? Yes. Well, to make it free just means they want somebody else to pay for it. That's a very different argument, that all of these things should be free to me and you should pay for them. We have an old word for that. It's called theft. If I hold a gun to your head and take resources from you without your consent, then I'm stealing from you. So charity is one thing, but they're not talking about charity. The people who want stuff to be free, they want to use their political power to take resources at gunpoint from people who earned them. Some story and basically says, and I deserve it more than you do because I don't have anything. Now, if you want to say that education should be subsidized for the people who are very poor, I am with that. I teach at Duke University, and we have a system where nearly 20% of our students are paying zero tuition. But those are poor people. That's not free tuition. Believe me, tuition at Duke is not free. It's very expensive. So if what you want to have is a system where we reduce the cost of healthcare, education, and food to those who are least able to care for themselves. We can talk about that. I understand what you're talking about. To say that college tuition should be free, even for wealthy people, makes no sense to me.
What is the lighthouse myth?
Well, in what context?
I'm sorry, on page 152 of your book, Is Capitalism Sustainable? You have a chapter titled The Lighthouse Myth.
Yeah. Economists tend to sit and think about things. And as an economist, I recognize this. I sit and think about things also. So famously, there were two British political economists, Sidgwick and John Stuart Mill. And both of them looked out the window, and in the distance near the coast, they saw a lighthouse. And they said, you know, that's really interesting. Lighthouses are really important for society because they prevent ships from running aground on the rocks. They enable navigation. They make it much cheaper for us to have commerce. But there's no way for private markets to provide lighthouses. Because when I look out there, I see that a ship far out at sea can see the light. How am I going to collect money? Oh, you saw the light. You got to pay. Well, that seems like that's not going to work. And so they said, clearly the government should provide lighthouses. You're going to recognize this for free. Well, it's not free. It actually costs something. It's a pretty substantial amount of cost. And so they were going to provide that from tax money. Now, what they could have done was stood their ass up and gone out and done some research. Because at the time that they wrote that markets could not provide lighthouses, 75% of the lighthouses in England were private. The lighthouses in England were private. They were privately provided because most of them were associated with a harbor or some way of providing provisions to the ship. And a small tax was charged without any state involvement. Now, you can say the state enforced the contract, but the state always enforces the contract. That's fine. In any private market, we expect, many of us expect, state enforcement of contracts and adjudication of disputes over contracts. That's a perfectly fine state function. So if you and I make an agreement and I have to pay, we have a dispute, we can go to court, we have police to protect property rights. So all the lighthouses in England needed was contract enforcement. They could be provided privately. And so interestingly, one of the most famous economists who was in favor of having a system of government provision and taxation to control the problem of public goods, Arthur C. Pigou, said, it's amazing what dumb ideas economists in their studies can get. And what by in their studies, what he means is you're sitting there thinking about stuff. Go out into the world and look at the creativity of human beings of coming up with institutions to solve these problems. Because in many cases, voluntary private associations can solve this problem long before the state has a bunch of committees and passes inefficient legislation to do it badly.
There is an old quote from Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations. He says, people of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices. Do you see that today when doing any research on rent seeking?
It's obviously a problem for people who want to say that any private contract should be legal. So suppose that the way that the market system, capitalist system is supposed to work, I am a producer. I go around and I write voluntary contracts with owners of labor, owners of capital, owners of plastic and metal, because I'm going to make something. Each of those voluntary contracts makes the supplier better off. Then put those things together. I pay workers to do it. I pay salespeople to sell them. All of them are better off because those are voluntary contracts. I then sell this in a market system. And consumers are better off because they're all buying it voluntarily. So the argument for markets is all of these voluntary contracts make every single one of the participants better off. And then if I still have some profits left over, it means that I'm creating value for the society. Now, I've forgotten your question. Say it again.
It was regarding the rent seeking that you discuss in the book.
Along with Adam Smith's quote. It was the Adam Smith quote. It was a very specific question. That was the thing. So what Adam Smith says is that there's another kind of contract. Contracts in restraint of trade. Now, contracts in restraint of trade are also voluntary. But instead of me hiring labor voluntarily, what I'm doing is saying, you know, you also produce cell phones. So Apple goes to Nokia and says, tell you what we should do is neither of us should sell phones below $1,000 because we'll make more profits. Well, that contract seems more problematic. And what Adam Smith recommends, if you look at the rest of that passage, is that we not make those contracts enforceable in law. We don't have to have antitrust. We just say those are not enforceable contracts. But what Adam Smith means in the following paragraph is, and I'm paraphrasing, but things in private markets are rarely so bad that the state cannot make them worse. And the way the state makes them worse is by requiring these businesses to organize into trade associations. So at least you don't need to have a list of people, all of whom are in this one business, so that they form a guild. You reduce the transaction cost of conspiring like this. So Smith says there's no way of stopping this. It's just going to happen. It's part of commercial society. But the state should not make it even more likely by having these trade associations. So Smith's intention, a lot of people on the left quote the passage that you just said, but they stop. If you go on, what Smith really says is, okay, that's going to happen. But things are rarely so bad that the state can't make it worse. Stop making it worse.
The average person might say, well, there are costs and that businesses have to acquire, and then there's what the consumer has to pay. And this sort of keeps us on balance until there is profit. Then you have one group exploiting another. This reaps more profits for one group of people, creating inequality and basically turning what could be a good exchange into something terrible and exploitative. On page 129, you write about in defense of profits. How would you defend profits to someone who has the mindset that I just communicated?
I've actually never understood that position, because they act as if everything should be spent either on the inputs or the price of the output. But there wouldn't be any output unless I'm an entrepreneur. So I show up and I notice that a bunch of people would like to buy this thing. Or in the case of Steve Jobs, I imagine a thing called an iPod that no one has ever thought of. But if they could see it, they would say, yes, I'd like to buy that. So Henry Ford famously said that if he'd asked customers what they wanted in 1915, they would have said horses.
Yeah.
They couldn't imagine an automobile, but once he showed them an automobile, they, wow, that's really great. I would like to have that. I would be willing to pay $1,000 for that. What does it cost? $400. That means that each consumer is making $600 on the transaction. So what we don't do is quantify the benefits of having access to markets. Consumers make a lot of money on what economists call consumer surplus. Consumer surplus is the difference between the price and what I would be willing to pay. The thing is that we never see that. That's not quantified. Profits are the difference between all of my input costs and the amount that consumers are willing to pay. That we can quantify. And it seems like if that's positive at all, that the system would be better without having profits, because workers and consumers would get that. There wouldn't be cars. We'd still be talking about faster horses. If there was no profit system, we would still be talking about faster horses. So the profits are a signal that no bureaucrat could match, that no elected official could possibly imagine, that these are activities we need more of. And what happens when more people, so there's high profits, more people come into the industry, and that drives profits down. So eventually, it's true, profits have a tendency towards zero, unless you get government protection. So the problem in a capitalist system, and there is a problem, is that rent seeking can result in substantial profits, but that's because you're preventing the market system from working.
Now, you could maybe look at a large number of the wealthy countries in the world and say, yes, they are more market-based, but this is only because of the socialist aspects of those countries. How would you communicate the value of free markets or capitalism to someone who says, if not but for the coercive state interfering in voluntary interactions, we would not have solved poverty at all? It would be far worse. That's the only thing that allows poverty to be solved in the first place.
I often hear people say stuff like that, And it turns out they have, it's like the economists in their studies, they should go look at the actual world. So Sweden, for example, which Bernie Sanders often mentions as being a model of socialism, is one of the most capitalist countries in the world. So after about 1991, 1992, Sweden decided they were going to get rid of all the socialist elements of their economy. So they privatized their school system. They privatized their pension system. They got rid of all their state-owned enterprises. They reduced the level of corporate income tax. It's less than half that in the United States. So what Sweden has is capitalism that they use to fund a redistributive system that takes care of the poor. So they don't manage prices. In fact, if you look, there's the Freedom Index. If you look at the set of restrictions that Sweden has on prices and on the ability to start a business, Sweden is more capitalist than the United States. So the difficult thing about the argument that you, and you're right, I hear it all the time, is it's not clear to me what they mean by socialism. If you take a robust capitalist system and just name it socialism, Keith, I'm for socialism too. But there's no definition of socialism that encompasses the countries of Northern Europe. They are all capitalist. They are thoroughly capitalist. Denmark, Norway, Germany, they are as capitalist as they can be. So it is true that the reason they did that was they recognized that was the way to produce enough income to fund a welfare state. But a welfare state is completely consistent with capitalism. It is a way of producing enough income. So what Sweden has is pretty substantial income equality. It's true. But they do not have wealth equality. There are more billionaires with a B per capita in Sweden than in the United States. So there are more really, really wealthy people in Sweden than in the United States. So the wealth inequality is enormous in these countries. Why? Because they are capitalist. They're not socialist. So what Bernie Sanders means by socialism is actually nonsense. It surprises me that people are so confused. And it's probably because they've never had an economics class. They just took political science from Bernie Sanders.
Well, there's a difference between what they're selling you. They're selling you Sweden, even though they're happy to justify Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Fidel Castro's actions in Cuba. And certainly they haven't said, here's where the state coercion is too much. This is the line right here and no further. So it's a great way to sell it to us.
I've had some debates with people about that, and eventually I did get... I had a Marxist debate opponent. I did get one of them to admit, okay, yes, that's actually true. I mean Sweden in 1972. Dude, Sweden in 1972 sucked. Nobody wants that. And Sweden thought it sucked. Sweden said, we're going to become capitalist. Voters wanted it. Politicians wanted it. Nobody wants socialism if they have a choice. The other countries that you mentioned, they became socialist at the point of a bayonet, either a revolution or, in the case of Hugo Chavez, a bunch of paramilitary. Nobody becomes socialist voluntarily.
You mentioned in the book that voting is one of the worst ways to make decisions. If I'm thinking about this, I might say in the market, you have this uncontrolled group of people, just everyone achieving their own ends in the predatory private sector. But in voting, I get a say. We all get a say. Why is voting one of the worst ways to make decisions?
Suppose we're going to go to a restaurant and we're going to have lunch. There's 12 of us. Now, one possibility is that we look at the menu and each of us order what we want. You're a vegetarian. I have a problem with gluten. Somebody else eats only meat, or maybe they're on a paleo diet. So each of us orders what we want at the restaurant. Now, we could use a different system. So we could look at the things on the menu, and we could have a rule that says we will all have the same lunch, and the way that we will choose that is whichever one gets majority rule. So it turns out that 51% like pizza with pepperoni on it. Now, the gluten-free guy, he can't eat pizza with pepperoni on it. The vegetarian can't eat pizza with pepperoni on it. So a voting system means that half of us choose for all of us. Furthermore, since my vote usually doesn't count very much, I may use what economists called rational irrationality. I decide not to do much research. And I have to say, Keith, one of the things that's kind of funny is that I don't get the way that you asked your question, what's so wrong with voting? I get that a lot less often since Donald Trump was elected. There's a lot of people on the left that used to talk about the wisdom of the people. Well, maybe not. So the fact is that sometimes in a democracy, you're going to get something you don't want. Now, for president, we're stuck with that. There's no alternative to voting. I understand that. But there's many situations where we start out by saying, what should we do? And my question is, why do you think there's a we? Why can't each of us choose what we want? And there's a lot of examples like the restaurant.
You mention in an article you wrote in the American Institute for Economic Research that markets work even if people are greedy or self-interested because the dynamics of competition limit bad actions. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Let's suppose that someone is a racist. So they don't like blue people. They just hate blue people. And there's some blue people who are in the workforce, but they never want to hire blue people. And there's quite a few of these racists that don't hire blue people. But it turns out that blue people are just like everybody else and are pretty good at working at this job. But if there's enough people who are racists, then the wage for blue people in terms of their value is going to be too low. Which means that if you have someone, just one person, who is not a racist, they want to hire a blue person, and they because they can charge a lower price because they're getting more productivity at a lower wage from that worker. And that means that all of the racists say, damn it, we have to hire blue people too. Because competitive forces require that if you're going to survive, you have to maximize profit. So here's the interesting thing. Racism means people are not greedy enough. Racism can only survive if people are not maximizing profits. So the interesting example was that in 1947, when Branch Rickey hired the first African-American to be in the major leagues, when the color line was broken by Jackie Robinson, Branch Rickey was not a racist, it's true, but what he was a greedy bastard. All of the people who looked at Branch Rickey's contract negotiation said he was just a penny pincher, but he noticed that African-American players were really excellent. He could hire them at a lower price, and he was likely to get more African-American people coming to the Brooklyn Dodger Stadium. So profits said, hire black people. Racism said, don't hire black people. Who won? Profits. And before long, Boston, New York, all of the really racist ball clubs were forced, and I mean forced, to hire black people because the alternative was they were going to lose and they were going to lose profits. So in a competitive system, I understand people have all sorts of prejudices. We have all sorts of bad desires. In a competitive market system, the only thing you get to care about is profits. The result is that you have to act as if you're a good person. That's really important. You have to act as if you're a good person. And the interesting thing is it's the opposite of the way most people think about capitalism.
Final question, who is your favorite economist and what is the major thing you learned from them?
My favorite economist is James Buchanan, who won the Nobel Prize in 1986. And I'm in the political science department. What James Buchanan did was found what's called the public choice school of political economy. And he was interested in the difficulty of choosing rules. So consumers have preferences over ice cream and sandwiches and different things that we like. James Buchanan said, how would we choose rules? How should we think about rules? And what he showed is that in collective choice processes, because sometimes we have to choose by voting, I get that. but different voting systems have different properties. So rules matter more than they should. So if you were to summarize public choice, it's that rules matter more than they should. We can't just always argue about stuff and then use majorities. The problem is, having a system like the Electoral College, like the Senate, is a way of protecting individual rights. And so having a voting system that also protects individual rights is a problem that we, that human beings have been trying to deal with forever. The public choice approach that was founded by James Buchanan gives us a start of doing that, and that's why he's my favorite economist.
Excellent. Everyone, the book is Capitalism Sustainable? By our guest today, Michael Munger. Sir, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.